This is Scott Becker with Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled to be joined today by Molly Gamble, leader of the editorial team at Becker's Healthcare. And she talks to us regularly about issues she's watching closely in healthcare. Molly, let me tee it up and ask you, what's the story that you're watching most closely today? And let's talk about that.
Okay, thank you, Scott. I leading into the podcast today, I was reflecting on Q1 as we begin to near its final stretch and some of the developments and conversations that have struck me most and stayed with me. And these aren't hard news stories per se, Scott, but I think some higher level trends, if we can go over three of those, I came to the table with.
That would be fantastic. Thank you very, very much. What are some of those?
Well, one was a conversation. It occurred a few weeks ago. I was able to sit down with half a dozen operational leaders at large integrated systems or prestigious medical centers, academic medical centers across the country. And we spoke for 60 minutes. And Scott, the number of topics that these leaders were able to speak to in depth was just astounding. Staffing, retention, union labor relations, EHR go lives, AI pilots, capital brick and mortar planning, down to the level of street closures. One system that's of household name recognition has 33 moves planned this year between spaces, space utilization, at-risk reimbursement, volumes, so much more. The list can go on and on. And, you know, Scott, something that really stood out to me here is, you know, you often hear these two frameworks, either you got someone who's a mile wide and an inch deep, or the reverse, an inch wide and a mile deep. And the COOs, I mean, they were closer to a mile wide, a mile deep, if anything. Healthcare operations, not something you need or want to have much surface level understanding of. The level of connective tissue they had to so many things, it was just really remarkable.
And talk about this for a moment, because when you mention all these different complex issues, and there's so many of them, and they're all challenging. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of easy wins. I was talking to a CEO the other day who's been with the system for 30 years, and he was in as positive way as possible saying, it's not getting any easier. There's so much complexity and so many challenges. Talk about that as you go through these discussions, how that feels and how that sense is.
I couldn't agree more. And I think what struck me most was you've seen sometimes the big business outlets will do this reporting about companies cutting the COO position, or a COO will leave and they're not replaced. It's a pretty undersung role. And in this conversation I had, I mean, the level of taking something, a factor today, and how it could play out and affect things 20 items down the line, it's hard to replace that. Their institutional knowledge. I think anytime, I know, Scott, we've talked about this before, but when companies reduce or diminish the presence of COOs, it often seems like a move that it's cutting one's nose to spite your face. We don't really hear much about the effects of that move, but my guess would be those operational issues either float up to the CEO and then detract from their time and focus, or are absorbed by this messy phone tree of other senior leaders. But the things these folks were touching and the level of detail they could go into each, it was, I don't know how we would have categorized the call. I mean, operations was what we categorized it as. And I think that's true to name, but I was really impressed by how we touched technology, we touched HR, we touched capital and strategy. They really had a hand in so many buckets.
No, thank you. We saw this, you know, the story the other day about another system double-hatting the CFO and the COO. And I just think it's a very, very short-term solution and not a smart long-term solution. And every leadership team needs someone who's overall in charge of looking at, is everything running well, who can bleed into those roles, all those roles. And I just think it's critical, that chief operating officer role in almost every organization. I couldn't agree with you more. So thank you. And what else are you watching closely, Molly? What else is top of mind to you right now?
This other thing I've been really paying more attention to is this year, I think, was kind of a mile marker. We've been talking about the workforce for a long time, and I'm starting to parse out and detect these different levels of action, and systems could be living in a few of these levels at the same time. I think the third is much more rare to come by, at least on the record. But I'd be curious, Scott, for your thoughts here too. But, you know, the first level around workforce and planning is immediate and pretty tech heavy. So this is where you have organizations deploying AI ambient clinical intelligence, keystroke or click saving measures, and other tools that can more immediately support workflows, productivity, even morale. Are these things transformative? Usually not. They're increasingly common. They also, the results aren't quite yet in and measured. We're still really looking for more information about how these tools translate directly into savings, whether that's time, dollars, or adding capacity. But that's kind of the first level. Then building up from there, the next level, I would say, is more midterm thinking about the workforce. You're starting to see more larger systems move in this direction if they aren't there already. These are systems that are working really hard to strengthen their pipeline programs, revisiting qualification requirements. Do you need a college degree for that position? Maybe they're putting more toward partnerships with schools, trying to make some positive impressions on more young students to get them interested in healthcare medicine. And they could even be looking toward things like affordable housing. What else is going on in their communities that might be helping or hindering their recruitment efforts? So this is midterm. This is still really tough work. It's not always easy to measure the returns of those efforts. And then Scott, the last level is, I think we're, there might be less activity right now, but I think that'll change. And this is the transformative level of thinking. I think few systems are here, at least openly, because there's a lot of risk involved here. You have some CEOs charging their teams to imagine and map out a care delivery model that's fundamentally different from today. And I would argue that's really hard to do in isolation if you don't have medical schools, higher education involved, unions, the professional associations, any sense of reimbursement. It's really tough to, quote, imagine that.
But you're getting to the spot where ultimately so much of the rubber hits the road. Because what you're talking about in the first two things, I think you've nailed this, Molly. And when people talk about this generative AI or next level, they're talking about where to different ways of doing things really replace or really, really supplement or reduce our reliance on humans in every aspect of things, whereas the first two things are ways to give humans more time, whether it's ambient technology, less keystrokes, lots of things that take some of the stress and burn off of humans. The second thing is to find more humans by changing what we determine are the right qualifications for whatever job it is. The third is, where can a human or non-human take things from point A to point D with very little supervision? You know, where can machines, technology sort of take over some of the efforts? And I think that's where there's the potential. And this is really complicated because I was just in the hospital for a surgical procedure. I certainly love the amount of staffing the health system had, how well taken care of I felt, just fantastic. We all want that. And how do you mix that with becoming less reliant on so much labor in a world where labor is very expensive and we just have too many people to take care of people, 330 million people in our country, with the amount of caregivers that we have? So it's that third level, the generative AI spot, the spot where technology really, it does replace in part humans, and they're not, it's still going to be supplemented by humans or mixed with humans, but where do you take out, a certain amount of work? We already see this in some administrative tasks where revenue cycle, if you used to have 1,000 people in a bullpen, maybe today you have to have 800 or 900 because you're using AI for a lot of menial tasks. But where do you get to that spot where AI actually in technology takes over from humans? And I think that's where the rubber hits the road. And you mentioned the union constituents. We're starting to see the return of clinical staffing ratios in certain states. New York adapted a new clinical ratio. You know, it's never driven by consumer protection. It's really driven by unions trying to protect their position, all this. And it's a fascinating thing. But Molly, let me turn it back to you before I just keep on talking.
No, I think you summed it up. And I think, Scott, I know the one other stakeholder we've spent some time talking about is medical schools and higher ed. And I was really interested a couple of weeks ago to learn about how much this one system is spending about cumulatively like about a year's time retraining nursing grads on the job, because they are seeing that these students or graduates are spending a lot of time in simulation and then not as much on the job. So then in addition to just getting that position filled and recruited and staffed, then you have to spend a year's time retraining them and re-educating in some ways. So that's also signaling that there's some gaps. And I know we've said the same about medical schools, the need for change is there. So I feel for health systems. I think there needs to be some really robust collaboration here from a lot of different stakeholders, that sometimes they're the ones that are pushed to speak to the solutions. And it's tricky to do that in isolation. You need to have a lot of other players on board.
But something you just mentioned was just fascinating, actually, because a couple of years ago, the limiting step in the program of producing more nurses was there wasn't enough nurse faculty to sort of train nurses how we used to do it, with lots of apprenticing and lots of side-by-side and lots of bedside work. And so over a couple of year period, moved towards more simulated training, virtual training, and so forth. And obviously what you find is, and obviously the wrong word, that the right answer is probably somewhere in between, because you could turn out nurses quicker without the simulated training, but it's not as good as actually bedside training. So trying to get this right balance of how do we turn out enough nurses, get them enough training, but don't go to a spot where the training is just impossible to get done. So how do you get this right balance on? And that's a fascinating evolution of exactly what's happened in the last 3 to 5 years. There was a shortage of nursing educators, so we couldn't educate enough nurses. More simulation, more virtual, and then nurses come out great, but not quite as prepared as they would have otherwise, because they didn't get enough of the hands-on real training. A fascinating sort of mix of trying to find solutions and ultimately the right solutions somewhere in between, I'm sure. But that's fascinating, Molly.
I think the last point, Scott, probably that same thought about somewhere in the middle carries over here too. And this one, you know, this is more my opinion than anything. I should make that known from the top, but we've seen a few bigger ranking systems within the past year kind of swiftly modify how they present performance, whether it's at the hospital level, more recently the county level. This week, we just checked in with Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and University of Wisconsin. For years, I think more than a decade, they have ranked the health of counties. So you can look up Illinois, where we are, and see every county A through Z and where they fell on a ranking of health. So that, you know, health outcomes, physical environment, a lot of different factors, more than 90 factors. And this year, the groups decided that that presentation was no longer going to be ranked. Instead, they have this system where each county gets a dot, they shade it a certain color, they place it on a gradient or a continuum, as they call it. And they said that it was based on the changes were based on feedback, and then also to give outcomes more nuance. And Scott, I don't know if there's a black and white answer here, right or wrong, but we've seen US News do the same. They took their top 20 hospitals on honor roll and took out the numbers. So now you have a class of honor rollees that are recognized as such. It's no longer a matter of 1 through 20. You know, systems 1 and 2 are just as prized as systems 18 and 19. And it reminds me a lot of the struggle high schools have been through since the late, I think, 1980s around class rank. You know, some would say, there's too much performance anxiety. This is too much stress. We're going to do away with class rank. I think there's more than one answer here, depending on where people sit with this. But it is interesting how things like health outcomes, I would argue, should not be nuanced. I think we need to know where things stand. And so these efforts to take away the numerical rankings, I can see some arguments for them. At the same time, I can also start to worry that down the line, we might regret moving away from that kind of framework.
Right. It's really a complicated subject, because with at least high school rankings, people had true grades and stats and scores to rank them. With the hospitals, ranking one hospital versus another, you know, there is a lot of subjectivity added to the objectivity. And so when they come out with this year, Cleveland Clinic was number one, last year, Cedars-Sinai was number two, whatever the numbers are, it is very hard to not think that there's some subjectivity in that. And so trying to get that right balance is really, really hard in these things. But no question. Very, very challenging.
Yeah. And then there's a lot of different, I think, concerns and people brought to the table. And I think they're somewhere in the middle, because I think to your point, jockeying over 1 to 2 or 3 to 4, I can see where that might be. It can lead to some problematic thinking. I remember CEO of Penn Hospitals told us that the reason they decided not to participate was because they were thinking about acquiring a struggling hospital nearby. And somebody came to that meeting with the question, well, what will this do if it's licensed under our system? What will that do to our ranking? So I can see how if you're so focused on it and it's really leading a lot of strategy, it can be a problem. At the same time, you know, doing away with it, I'm not sure that's always the best solution either.
It really is a fine line. Somebody aims totally towards academic excellence versus community benefit, and the community benefit doesn't show up as well in the survey, then they're scared to go after community benefit like they are with academic excellence. What a fascinating perspective, and don't want those to impact great community decisions. Things are great for the community, not just health system ranking. What a fascinating set of subjects. Molly, as always, I want to thank you for joining us in the Becker's Healthcare Podcast for all the coverage you do. What a fascinating set of issues. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Scott.